She's only 25, Jenny pursued. Young enough for more bairns, and a good mother. How much of that whiskey have you had?
Her brother bent forward and pretended to examine the level of the decanter, cupping the baby's head in one palm to prevent it wobbling. He straightened up and gave his sister a look of mild exasperation.
I'm living like an animal in a cave, and you wish me to take a wife?
He felt suddenly hollow inside. To prevent her seeing that the suggestion had upset him, he rose and walked up and down the room, making unnecessary small humming noises to the bundle in his arms.
"How long is it since you've lain with a woman, Jamie?" his sister asked conversationally behind him.
Shocked, he turned on his heel to stare at her.
"What the hell sort of question is that to ask a man?"
"You've not gone with any of the unwed lasses between Lallybroch and Broch Moder," she went on, paying no attention. "Or I'd have heard of it."
"None of the widows either, I dinna think."
She paused delicately.
"You know damn well I haven't," he said shortly.
He could feel his cheeks flushing with annoyance.
"Why not?"
his sister asked bluntly.
"Why not?"
He stared at her, his mouth slightly open.
"Have you lost your senses? What do you think? I'm the sort of man would slink about from house to house, bedding any woman who didn't drive me out with a girdle in her hand?"
"As if they would." "No, you're a good man, Jamie." Jenny smiled, half sadly. "You wouldn't take advantage of any woman. You'd marry first, no?"
"No,"
he said violently. The baby twitched and made a sleepy sound, and he transferred it automatically to his other shoulder, patting as he glared at his sister.
"I didn't mean to marry again, so you just abandon all thought of matchmaking, Jenny Murray. I will not have it, you hear?"
"Oh, I hear," she said, unperturbed. She pushed herself higher on the pillow so as to look him in the eye. "You mean to live like a monk to the end of your days?" she asked. "Go to your grave with no son to bury you or bless your name?"
"Mind your own business, damn you!"
Heart pounding, he turned his back on her and strode to the window, where he stood staring sightlessly out over the stable yard.
"I ken you mourn Claire."
His sister's voice came softly from behind him.
"Do you think I could forget Ian if it doesn't come back?" "But it's time you went on, Jamie. You didn't think Claire would mean you to live alone all your life, with no one to comfort you or bear your children?"
He didn't answer for a long time, just stood, feeling the soft heat of the small fuzzy head pressed against the side of his neck. He could see himself dimly in the misted glass, a tall, dirty gangle of a man, the round white bundle incongruous beneath his own grim face.
"She was with child," he said softly at last, speaking to the reflection. When I lost her."
How else could he put it? There was no way to tell his sister where Claire was, where he hoped she was. That he couldn't think of another woman, hoping that Claire still lived, even knowing her truly lost to him for good. There was a long silence from the bed. Then Jenny said quietly,
"Is that why you came today?"
He sighed and turned sideways toward her, leaning his head against the cool glass. His sister was lying back, her dark hair loose on the pillow, eyes gone soft as she looked at him.
"Aye, maybe," he said. "I couldna help my wife. I suppose I thought I might help you. Not that I could," he added with some bitterness. "I am as useless to you as I was to her."
Jenny stretched out a hand to him, face filled with distress.
"Jamie, mon cœur," she said.
but then stopped, eyes widening in sudden alarm as a splintering crash and the sound of screams came from the house below. "Holy Mary," she said, growing even whiter. "It's the English!"
"Christ!"
It was as much a prayer as an exclamation of surprise. He glanced quickly from the bed to the window, judging the possibilities of hiding versus those of escape. The sounds of booted feet were already on the stair.
"The cupboard, Jamie,"
Jenny whispered urgently, pointing. Without hesitation, he stepped into the armoire and pulled the door to behind him. The door of the chamber sprang open with a crash a moment later, to be filled with a red-coated figure in a cocked hat, holding a drawn sword before him. The captain of dragoons paused and darted his eyes all around the chamber, finally settling on the small figure in the bed.
"Mrs. Murray," he said.
Jenny struggled to pull herself upright.
"I am. And what in flaming hell are you doing in my house?" she demanded.
Her face was pale and shiny with sweat, and her arms trembled, but she held her chin up and glared at the man.
"Get out!"
Disregarding her, the man moved into the room and over to the window. Jamie could see his indistinct form disappear past the edge of the wardrobe, then reappear, back turned, as he spoke to Jenny.
"One of my scouts reported hearing a shot from the vicinity of this house not long since. Where are your men?"
"I have none."
Her trembling arms wouldn't support her any longer, and Jamie saw his sister ease herself back, collapsing on the pillows.
"You've taken my husband already. My eldest son is no more than 10.
She didn't mention Rabbi or Fergus. Boys of their age were old enough to be treated, or mistreated, as men, should the captain take the notion. With luck, they would have taken to their heels at the first sight of the English. The captain was a hard-bitten man of middle age, and not overly given to credulity.
"The keeping of weapons in the Highlands is a serious offence," he said, and turned to the soldier who had come into the room behind him. "Search the house, Jenkins."
He had to raise his voice in the giving of the order, for there was a rising commotion in the stairwell. As Jenkins turned to leave the room, Mrs. Innes, the midwife, burst past the soldier who tried to bar her way.
"Leave the poor lady alone," she cried,
facing the captain with fists clenched at her sides. The midwife's voice shook, and her hair was coming down from its snood, but she stood her ground.
"Get out, ye wretches! Leave her be!"
"I'm not mistreating your mistress,"
the captain said with some irritation, evidently mistaking Mrs. Innes for one of the maids.
"I am merely..."
"And her not delivered but an hour since.
It isn't a decent even for ye to lay eyes on her so much as..." "Delivered."
The captain's voice sharpened, and he glanced from the midwife to the bed in sudden interest.
"You have borne a child, Mrs. Murray. Where is the infant?"
The infant in question stirred inside its wrappings, disturbed by the tightened grip of its horror-stricken uncle. From the depths of the wardrobe, he could see his sister's face, white to the lips and set like stone.
"The child is dead," she said.
The midwife's mouth dropped open in shock, but luckily the captain's attention was riveted on Jenny.
"Oh," he said slowly. "Was it?"
"Mama!"
The cry of anguish came from the doorway as young Jamie broke free of a soldier's grip and hurled himself at his mother.
"Mama, the baby's dead! No, no!"
Sobbing, he flung himself on his knees and buried his head in the bedclothes. As though to refute his brother's statement, baby Ian gave evidence of his living state by kicking his legs with considerable vigour against his uncle's ribs, and emitting a series of small snuffling grunts, which fortunately went unheard in the commotion outside. Jenny was trying to comfort young Jamie. Mrs. Innes was futilely attempting to raise the boy, who kept a death grip on his mother's sleeve. The captain was vainly trying to make himself heard above young Jamie's grief-stricken wails, and over all, the muted sound of boots and shouting vibrated through the house. Jamie rather thought the captain was inquiring as to the location of the infant's body. He clutched the body in question closer, joggling it in an attempt to prevent any disposition on its part to cry. His other hand went to the hilt of his dirk, but it was a vain gesture. It was doubtful that even cutting his own throat would be of help if the wardrobe were opened. Baby Ian made an irascible noise, suggesting that he disliked being joggled. With visions of the house in flames and the inhabitants slaughtered, the noise sounded as loud to Jamie as his elder nephew's anguished howls. "You did it!" Young Jamie had gotten to his feet, face wet and swollen with tears and rage, and was advancing on the captain, curly black head lowered like a small ram's. "You killed my brother, you English prick!" The captain was somewhat taken aback by this sudden attack, and actually took a step back, blinking at the boy.
"No, boy, you're quite mistaken. Why, I only..."
"Prick! Good!" Entirely beside himself, young Jamie was stalking the captain, yelling every obscenity he had ever heard used, in Gaelic or English. "Meh," said baby Ian in the elder Jamie's ear. "Meh, meh." This sounded very much like the preliminary to a full-fledged screech, and in a panic, Jamie let go of his dirk and thrust his thumb into the soft, moist opening from which the sounds were issuing. The baby's toothless gums clamped onto his thumb with a ferocity that nearly made him exclaim aloud.
"Get out! Get out! Get out or I'll kill you!"
Young Jamie was screaming at the captain, face contorted with rage. The redcoat looked helplessly at the bed, as though to ask Jenny to call off this implacable small foe. But she lay as though dead, with her eyes closed.
"I shall wait for my men downstairs," the captain said, with what dignity he could,
and withdrew, shutting the door hastily behind him. Deprived of his enemy, young Jamie fell to the floor and collapsed into helpless weeping. Through the crack in the door, Jamie saw Mrs. Innes look at Jenny, mouth opening to ask a question. Jenny shot up from the bedclothes like Lazarus, scowling ferociously, finger pressed to her lips to enjoin silence. Baby Ian champed viciously at the thumb, growling at its failure to yield any sustenance. Jenny swung herself to the side of the bed and sat there, waiting. The sounds of the soldiers below throbbed and eddied through the house. Jenny was shaking with weakness, but she reached out a hand toward the armoire where her men lay hidden. Jamie drew a deep breath and braced himself. It would have to be risked. His hand and wrist were wet with saliva, and the baby's growls of frustration were growing louder. He stumbled from the wardrobe, drenched with sweat, and thrust the infant at Jenny. Baring her breast with a single wrench, she pressed the small head to her nipple and bent over the tiny bundle as though to protect it. The beginnings of a squawk disappeared into the muffled sounds of vigorous sucking, and Jamie sat down on the floor quite suddenly, feeling as though someone had run a sword behind his knees. Young Jamie had sat up at the sudden opening of the wardrobe, and now sat spraddled against the door, his face blank with bewildered shock as he looked from his mother to his uncle and back again. Mrs. Innes knelt beside him, whispering urgently in his ear, but no sign of comprehension showed on the small, tear-streaked face. By the time shouts and the creaking of harness outside betokened the soldier's departure, young Ian lay replete and snoring in his mother's arms. Jamie stood by the window, just out of sight, watching them go. The room was silent, save for the liquid noise of Mrs. Innes drinking whiskey. Young Jamie sat close against his mother, cheek pressed to her shoulder. She hadn't looked up once since taking the baby, and still sat, head lowered, over the child in her lap, her black hair hiding her face. Jamie stepped forward and touched her shoulder. The warmth of her seemed shocking, as though cold dread were his natural state, and the touch of another person somehow foreign and unnatural.
"I'll go to the priest hole," he said softly.
and to the cave when it's dark.
Jenny nodded, but without looking up at him. There were several white hairs among the black, he saw, glinting silver by the parting down the centre of her head.
I think I should not come down again, he said at last, for a time.
Jenny said nothing, but nodded once more. Chapter 6. Being now justified by his blood. As it was, he did come down to the house once more. For 2 months he stayed close hidden in the cave, scarcely daring to come out at night to hunt, for the English soldiers were still in the district, quartered at Comar. The troops went out by day in small patrols of 8 or 10, combing the countryside, looting what little there was to steal, destroying what they could not use, and all with the blessing of the English crown. A path led close by the base of the hill where his cavern was concealed. No more than a rude track, it had begun as a deer path, and still largely served that use, though it was a foolish stag that would venture within smelling distance of the cave. Still, sometimes, when the wind was right, he would see a small group of the red deer on the path, or find fresh spoor in the exposed mud of the track next day. It was helpful as well for such people as had business on the mountainside, few enough as those were. The wind had been blowing downwind from the cave, and he had no expectation of seeing deer. He had been lying on the ground just within the cave entrance, where enough light filtered through the overhanging screen of gorse and rowan for him to read on fine days. There were not a great many books, but Jared managed still to smuggle a few with his gifts from France. "This violent rain forced me to a new work, to cut a hole through my new fortification like a sink, to let the water go out, which would else have drowned my cave. After I had been in my cave some time and found still no more shocks of the earthquake follow, I began to be more composed, and now, to support my spirits, which indeed wanted it very much, I went to my little store and took a small sup of rum, which, however, I did then, and always very sparingly, knowing I could have no more when that was gone. It continued raining all that night, and great part of the next day, so that I could not stir abroad, but my mind being more composed, I began to think. The shadows across the page moved as the bushes above him stirred. Instincts attuned, he caught the shift of the wind at once, and on it the sound of voices. He sprang to his feet, hand on the dirk that never left his side. Barely pausing to put the book carefully on its ledge, he grasped the knob of granite that he used as a handhold and pulled himself up into the steep, narrow crevice that formed the cave's entrance. The bright flash of red and metal on the path below hit him with a blow of shock and annoyance. Damn! He had little fear that any of the soldiers would leave the path. They were poorly equipped for making their way even through the normal stretches of open, spongy peat and heather, let alone an overgrown, brambly slope like this. But having them so close meant he couldn't risk leaving the cave before dark, even to get water or relieve himself. He cast a quick glance at his water jug, knowing as he did so that it was nearly empty. A shout pulled his attention back to the track below, and he nearly lost his grip on the rock. The soldiers had bunched themselves around a small figure, humped under the weight of a small cask it bore on its shoulders. Fergus, on his way up with a cask of fresh-brewed ale. Damn and damn again! He could have done with that ale. It had been months since he'd had any. The wind had changed again, so he caught only small snatches of words, but the small figure seemed to be arguing with a soldier in front of him, gesticulating violently with its free hand. "Idiot," said Jamie under his breath. "Give it to them and be gone, you weak clot." One soldier made a two-handed grab at the cask and missed as a small dark-haired figure jumped nimbly back. Jamie smacked himself on the forehead with exasperation. Fergus could never resist insolence when confronted with authority.
especially English authority. The small figure was now skipping backward, shouting something at his pursuers.
"Fool!" Jamie said violently. "Drop it and run!"
Instead of either dropping the cask or running, Fergus, apparently sure of his own speed, turned his back on the soldiers and waggled his rump insultingly at them. Sufficiently incensed to risk their footing in the soggy vegetation, several of the redcoats jumped the path to follow. Jamie saw their leader raise an arm and shout in warning. It had evidently dawned on him that Fergus might be a decoy trying to lead them into ambush. But Fergus too was shouting, and evidently the soldiers knew enough gutter French to interpret what he was saying. For while several of the men halted at their leader's shout, four of the soldiers hurled themselves at the dancing boy. There was a scuffle and more shouting as Fergus dodged, twisting like an eel between the soldiers. In all the commotion and above the whining wind, Jamie couldn't have heard the rush of the sabre being drawn from its scabbard, but ever after felt as though he had, as though the faint swish and ring of drawn metal had been the first inkling of disaster. It seemed to ring in his ears whenever he remembered the scene, and he remembered it for a very long time. Perhaps it was something in the attitudes of the soldiers, an irritableness of mood that communicated itself to him in the cave. Perhaps only the sense of doom that had clung to him since Culloden, as though everything in his vicinity were tainted. At risk, by virtue only of being near him. Whether he had heard the sound of the sabre or not, his body had tensed itself to spring before he saw the silver arc of the blade swing through the air. It moved almost lazily, slowly enough for his brain to have tracked its arc, deduced its target, and shouted wordless, "No!" Surely it moved slowly enough so that he could have darted down into the midst of the swarming men, seized the wrist that wielded the sword, and twisted the deadly length of metal free, to tumble harmless to the ground. The conscious part of his brain told him this was nonsense, even as it froze his hands around the granite knob, anchoring him against the overwhelming impulse to heave himself out of the earth and run forward. "You can't," it said to him, a thready whisper under the fury and the horror that filled him. "He has done this for you. You cannot make it senseless." "You can't," it said, cold as death beneath the searing rush of futility that drowned him. "You can do nothing." And he did nothing. Nothing but watch, as the blade completed its lazy swing, crashed home with a small, almost inconsequential thunk, and the disputed cask tumbled end over end over end down the slope of the burn, its final splash lost in the merry gurgle of brown water far below. The shouting ceased abruptly in shocked silence. He scarcely heard when it resumed. It sounded so much like the roaring in his ears. His knees gave way, and he realized dimly that he was about to faint. His vision darkened into reddish black, shot with stars and streaks of light. But not even the encroaching dark would blot out the final sight of Fergus's hand, that small and deft and clever pickpocket's hand, lying still in the mud of the track, palm turned upward in supplication. He waited for 48 long, dragging hours before Rabbi McNab came to whistle on the path below the cave. "How is he?" he said without preliminary.
"Mrs. Jenny says he'll be all right," Rabbi answered.
His young face was pale and drawn. Plainly he hadn't yet recovered from the shock of his friend's accident.
"She says he's not fevered, and there's no trace of rot yet in the..."
He swallowed audibly.
"In the stump?"
"The soldiers took him down to the house, then?"
Not waiting for an answer, he was already making his way down the hillside.
"Aye, they were all a mile wi' it, I think."
Rabbi paused to disentangle his shirt from a clinging briar
and had to hurry to catch up with his employer. I think they were sorry about it. A captain said so, at least, and he gave Mrs. Jinny a gold sovereign. For Fergus.
Oh, aye, Jamie said. Very generous.
And didn't speak again until they reached the house. Fergus was lying in state in the nursery, ensconced in a bed by the window. His eyes were closed when Jamie entered the room, long lashes lying softly against thin cheeks. Seen without its customary animation, his usual array of grimaces and poses, his face looked quite different. The slightly beaked nose above the long, mobile mouth gave him a faintly aristocratic air, and the bones hardening beneath the skin gave some promise that his face might one day pass from boyish charm to outright handsomeness. Jamie moved toward the bed, and the dark lashes lifted at once.
"My lord," Fergus said,
and a weak smile restored his face at once to its familiar contours.
"You are safe here? God, laddie, I'm sorry."
Jamie sank to his knees by the bed. He could scarcely bear to look at the slender forearm that lay across the quilt, its frail bandaged wrist ending in nothing, but forced himself to grip Fergus's shoulder in greeting and rub a palm gently over the shock of dark hair.
"Does it hurt much?" he asked.
"No, my lord," Fergus said.
Then a sudden belying twinge of pain crossed his features, and he grinned shamefacedly.
"Well, not so much. And madame has been most generous with the whisky."
There was a tumbler full of it on the side table, but no more than a thimbleful had been drunk. Fergus, weaned on French wine, didn't really like the taste of whisky.
"I'm sorry," Jamie said again.
There was nothing else to say. Nothing he could say, for the tightening in his throat. He looked hastily down, knowing that it would upset Fergus to see him weep.
"Ah, my lord, do not trouble yourself."
There was a note of the old mischief in Fergus's voice.
"Me? I have been fortunate."
Jamie swallowed hard before replying.
"Aye, you're alive, and thank God for it." "Oh, beyond that, my lord."
He glanced up to see Fergus smiling, though still very pale.
"Do you not recall our agreement, my lord?"
"Agreement?"
"Yes. When you took me into your service in Paris, you told me then that should I be arrested and executed, you would have masses said for my soul for the space of a year."
The remaining hand fluttered toward the battered greenish medal that hung about his neck. St. Dismas, patron saint of thieves.
"But if I should lose an ear or a hand while doing your service?"
"I would support you for the rest of your life."
Jamie was unsure whether to laugh or cry, and contented himself with patting the hand that now lay quiet on the quilt.
"Aye. I remember. You may trust me to keep the bargain."
"Oh, I've always trusted you, my lord,"
Fergus assured him. Clearly he was growing tired. The pale cheeks were even whiter than they had been, and the shock of black hair fell back against the pillow.
"So I'm fortunate," he murmured, still smiling. "For in one stroke I am become a gentleman of leisure, no?"
Jenny was waiting for him when he left Fergus's room.
"Come down to the priest hall, Weema," he said, taking her by the elbow. "I need to talk with you a bit, and I shouldn't stay in the open longer."
She followed him without comment down to the stone-floored back hall that separated kitchen and pantry. Set into the flags of the floor was a large wooden panel, perforated with drilled holes, apparently mortared into the floor stones. Theoretically, this gave air to the root cellar below, and in fact, should any suspicious person choose to investigate, the root cellar, reached by a sunken door outside the house, did have just such a panel set into its ceiling. What was not apparent was that the panel also gave light and air to a small priest hole that had been built just behind the root cellar, which could be reached by pulling up the panel, mortared frame and all, to reveal a short ladder leading down into the tiny room. It was no more than 5 feet square, equipped with nothing in the way of furniture beyond a rude bench, a blanket, and a chamber pot. A large jug of water and a small box of hard biscuit completed the chamber's accoutrements. It had, in fact, been added to the house only within the last few years, and therefore wasn't really a priest hole, as no priest had occupied it, or was likely to. A hole it definitely was, though. Two people could occupy the hole only by sitting side by side on the bench, and Jamie sat down beside his sister as soon as he had replaced the panel overhead and descended the ladder. He sat still for a moment, then took a breath and started.
"I canna bear it any more," he said.
He spoke so softly that Jenny was forced to bend her head close to hear him, like a priest receiving some penitent's confession.
"I can't. I must go."
They sat so close together that he could feel the rise and fall of her breast as she breathed. Then she reached out and took hold of his hand, her small, firm fingers tight on his.
"Will you try France again, then?"
He had tried to escape to France twice before, thwarted each time by the tight watch the English placed on all ports. No disguise was sufficient for a man of his remarkable height and colouring. He shook his head.
"No.
I shall let myself be captured."
"Jamie!"
In her agitation, Jenny allowed her voice to rise momentarily, then lowered it again in response to the warning squeeze of his hand.
"Jamie, you canna do that," she said lower. "Christ, man, you'll be hanged."
He kept his head bent, as though in thought, but shook it, not hesitating.
"I think not."
He glanced at his sister, then quickly away.
"Claire, she had the sight."
As good an explanation as any, he thought, if not quite the real truth.
"She saw what would happen at Culloden. She knew. And she told me what would come after."
"Ah," said Jenny softly. "I wondered. So that was why she bade me plant potatoes and build this place?"
"Aye."
He gave his sister's hand a small squeeze, then let go and turned slightly on the narrow seat to face her.
"She told me that the Crown would go on hunting Jacobite traitors for some time. And they have," he added wryly. "But that after the first few years, they would no longer execute the men that were captured, only imprison them."
"Only?" his sister echoed. "If you mun go, Jamie, take to the heather then. But to give yourself up to an English prison, whether they'll hang you or no."
"Wait."
His hand on her arm stopped her.
"I haven't told it all to you yet. I dinna mean just to walk up to the English and surrender. There's a goodly price on my head, no? Be ashamed to let that go to waste, do you not think?"
He tried to force a smile in his voice. She heard it and glanced sharply up at him.
"Holy Mother," she whispered. "So you mean to have someone betray you?"
"Seemingly, aye."
He had decided upon the plan alone in the cave, but it hadn't seemed quite real until now.
"I thought perhaps Joe Freezer would be best for it."
Jenny rubbed her fist hard against her lips. She was quick. He knew she had grasped the plan at once, and all its implications.
"But Jamie," she whispered, "even if they didna hang you outright,
and that's the hell of a risk to take."
"Jamie, you could be killed when they take you."
His shoulders slumped suddenly under the weight of misery and exhaustion.
"God, Jenny," he said, "d'you think I care?"
There was a long silence before she answered.
"No, I don't," she said.
and I canna say as I blame you either." She paused a moment to steady her voice. "But I still care." Her fingers gently touched the back of his head, stroking his hair. "So, you'll mind yourself, won't you, Clotted?"
The ventilation panel overhead darkened momentarily, and there was the tapping sound of light footsteps. One of the kitchen maids on her way to the pantry, perhaps. Then the dim light came back, and he could see Jenny's face once more.
"Aye," he whispered at last. "I'll mind."
It took more than 2 months to complete the arrangements. When at last word came, it was full spring. He sat on his favourite rock near the cave's entrance, watching the evening stars come out. Even in the worst of the year after Culloden, he had always been able to find a moment of peace at this time of the day. As the daylight faded, it was as though objects became faintly lit from within, so they stood outlined against sky or ground, perfect and sharp in every detail. He could see the shape of a moth, invisible in the light, now limned in the dusk with a triangle of deeper shadow that made it stand out from the trunk it hid upon. In a moment, it would take wing. He looked out across the valley, trying to stretch his eyes as far as the black pines that edged the distant cliffside. Then up among the stars. Orion there, striding stately over the horizon. And the Pleiades, barely visible in the darkening sky. It might be his last sight of the sky for some time, and he meant to enjoy it. He thought of prison, of bars and locks and solid walls, and remembered Fort William, Wentworth Prison, the Bastille. Walls of stone, 4 feet thick, that blocked all air and light. Filth, stench, hunger, entombment. He shrugged such thoughts away. He had chosen his way, and was satisfied with it. Still, he searched the sky, looking for Taurus. Not the prettiest of constellations, but his own. Born under the sign of the bull, stubborn and strong. Strong enough, he hoped, to do what he intended. Among the growing night sounds there was a sharp high whistle. It might have been the homing song of a curlew on the loch, but he recognised the signal. Someone was coming up the path. A friend. It was Mary McNab, who had become kitchen maid at Lullybroch after the death of her husband. Usually it was her son, Rabbi, or Fergus, who brought him food and news. But she had come a few times before. She had brought a basket, unusually well supplied, with a cold roast partridge, fresh bread, several young green onions, a bunch of early cherries, and a flask of ale. Jamie examined the bounty, then looked up with a wry smile. "My farewell feast, eh?" She nodded, silent. She was a small woman, dark hair heavily streaked with grey, and her face lined by the difficulties of life. Still, her eyes were soft and brown, and her lips still full and gently curved. He realised that he was staring at her mouth, and hastily turned again to the basket.
"Lord, I'll be so full and not be able to move. Even a cake now. However did ye ladies manage that?"
She shrugged. She wasn't a great chatterer, Mary McNab, and taking the basket from him, proceeded to lay the meal on the wooden tabletop balanced on stones. She laid places for both of them. This was nothing out of the ordinary. She had supped with him before to give him the gossip of the district while they ate. Still, if this was his last meal before leaving Lullybroch, he was surprised that neither his sister nor the boys had come to share it. Perhaps the farmhouse had visitors that would make it difficult for them to leave undetected. He gestured politely for her to sit first, before taking his own place, cross-legged, on the hard dirt floor.
"You've spoken with you, Fraser. Where is it to be, then?" he asked, taking a bite of cold partridge.
She told him the details of the plan,
A horse would be brought before dawn, and he would ride out of the narrow valley by way of the pass. Then turn, cross the rocky foothills, and come down, back into the valley, by Fisihunt's Burn, as though he were coming home. The English would meet him somewhere between Struy and Eskerdale, most likely at Midmains. It was a good place for an ambush, for the glen rose steeply there on both sides, but with a wooded patch by the stream where several men could conceal themselves.
This ends Disc 3. Voyager, Disc 4.
After the meal, she packed the basket tidily, leaving out enough food for a small breakfast before his dawn leaving. He expected her to go then, but she did not. She rummaged in the crevice where he kept his bedding, spread it neatly upon the floor, turned back the blankets, and knelt beside the pallet, hands folded on her lap. He leaned back against the wall of the cave, arms folded. He looked down at the crown of her bowed head in exasperation.
"Oh, like that, is it?" he demanded. "And whose idea was this? Yours or my sister's?"
"Does it matter?" She was composed, her hands perfectly still on her lap, her dark hair smooth in its snood. He shook his head and bent down to pull her to her feet.
"No, it doesn't matter, because it's no going to happen. I appreciate your meaning, but..."
His speech was interrupted by her kiss. Her lips were as soft as they looked. He grasped her firmly by both wrists and pushed her away from him.
"No," he said. "It isn't necessary, and I dunno want to do it."
He was uncomfortably aware that his body didn't agree at all with his assessments of necessity, and still more uncomfortable at the knowledge that his breeches, too small and worn thin, made the magnitude of the disagreement obvious to anyone who cared to look. The slight smile curving those full, sweet lips suggested that she was looking. He turned her toward the entrance and gave her a light push, to which she responded by stepping aside and reaching behind her for the fastenings to her skirt.
"Don't do that," he exclaimed.
"How do you mean to stop me?" she asked, stepping out of the garment and folding it tidily over the single stool. Her slender fingers went to the laces of her bodice.
"If you won't leave, then I'll have to," he replied with decision.
He whirled on his heel and headed for the cave entrance when he heard her voice behind him.
"My lord," she said.
He stopped, but didn't turn around.
"That isn't suitable to call me that," he said.
"Lallybroch is yours," she said, "and will be as long as you live. If you're its laird, I'll call you so."
"It isna mine. The estate belongs to young Jamie."
"It isna young Jamie that's doing what you are," she answered with decision. "And it isna your sister that asked me to do what I'm doing. Turn around." He turned, reluctantly. She stood barefoot in her shift, her hair loose over her shoulders. She was thin, as they all were these days, but her breasts were larger than he had thought, and the nipples showed prominently through the thin fabric. The shift was as worn as her other garments, frayed at the hem and shoulders, almost transparent in spots. He closed his eyes. He felt a light touch on his arm and willed himself to stand still.
"I ken weel enough what you're thinking," she said, "for I saw your lady, and I know how it was between the two of you."
"I never had that," she added in a softer voice.
"Not we either of the two men I wed. But I know the look of a true love, and it's not in my mind to make you feel you've betrayed it."
The touch, feather light, moved to his cheek, and a work-worn thumb traced the groove that ran from nose to mouth.
"What I want," she said quietly, "is to give you something different. Something less, mayhap. But something you can use. Something to keep you whole. Your sister and the bairns canna give you that. But I can."
He heard her draw breath, and the touch on his face lifted away. "You've given me my home, my life, and my son. Will you no let me gie you this small thing in return?" He felt tears sting his eyelids. The weightless touch moved across his face, wiping the moisture from his eyes, smoothing the roughness of his hair. He lifted his arms slowly and reached out. She stepped inside his embrace as neatly and simply as she had laid the table and the bed.
"I haven't done this in a long time," he said, suddenly shy.
"Neither have I," she said, with a tiny smile. "But we'll remember how it is." Part 3. When I Am Thy Captive. Chapter 7. A Faith in Documents. Inverness, May 25th, 1968. The envelope from Linklater arrived in the morning post. "Look how fat it is," Brianna exclaimed. "He's sent something." The tip of her nose was pink with excitement.
"Looks like it," said Roger.
He was outwardly calm, but I could see the pulse beating in the hollow of his throat. He picked up the thick manila envelope and held it for a moment, weighing it. Then he ripped the flap recklessly with his thumb and yanked out a sheaf of photocopied pages. The cover letter on heavy university stationery fluttered out. I snatched it from the floor and read it aloud, my voice shaking a little. "Dear Dr. Wakefield," I read, "this is in reply to your inquiry regarding the execution of Jacobite officers by the Duke of Cumberland's troops following the Battle of Culloden. The main source of the quote in my book to which you refer was the private journal of one Lord Melton in command of an infantry regiment under Cumberland at the time of Culloden. I have enclosed photocopies of the relevant pages of the journal. As you will see, the story of the survivor, one James Fraser, is an odd and touching one. Fraser is not an important historical character, and not in line with the thrust of my own work, but I have often thought of investigating further, in hopes of determining his eventual fate. Should you find that he did survive the journey to his own estate, I should be happy if you would inform me. I have always rather hoped that he did, though his situation, as described by Melton, makes the possibility seem unlikely. Sincerely yours, Eric Linklater." The paper rattled in my hand, and I set it down very carefully on the desk. "Unlikely, huh?" Brianna said, standing on tiptoe to see over Roger's shoulder. "Ah, he did make it back. We know he did."
"We think he did," Roger corrected.
But it was only scholarly caution. His grin was as broad as Brianna's.
"Will you be having tea or cocoa to your elevenses?"
Fiona's curly dark head poked through the study doorway, interrupting the excitement.
"There's fresh ginger nut biscuits, just baked."
The scent of warm ginger came into the study with her, wafting enticingly from her apron.
"Tea, please," said Roger,
just as Brianna said,
"Oh, cocoa sounds great."
Fiona, wearing a smug expression, pushed in the tea cart, sporting both tea cosy and pot of cocoa, as well as a plate of fresh ginger nut biscuits. I accepted a cup of tea myself, and sat down in the wing chair with the pages of Melton's journal. The flowing 18th century handwriting was surprisingly clear, in spite of the archaic spellings. And within minutes, I was in the confines of Leonach Farmhouse, imagining the sound of buzzing flies, the stir of close-packed bodies, and the harsh smell of blood soaking into the packed dirt floor.
"In satisfaction of my brother's debt of honour, I could not do otherwise than to spare Fraser's life. I therefore omitted his name from the list of traitors executed at the farmhouse, and have made arrangements for his transport to his own estate. I cannot feel myself either altogether merciful toward Fraser in the taking of this action, nor yet altogether culpable with respect to my service toward the Duke, as Fraser's situation, with a great wound in his leg festering and pustulant, makes it unlikely that he will survive the journey to his home. Still, honour prevents my acting otherwise, and I will confess that my spirit was lightened to see the man removed, still living, from the field, as I turned my own attentions to the melancholy task of disposing of the bodies of his comrades. So much killing as I have seen these last 2 days oppresses me.
The entry ended simply. I laid the pages down on my knee, swallowing heavily. A great wound, festering and pustulant.
I knew, as Roger and Brianna could not, just how serious such a wound would have been, with no antibiotics, nothing in the way of proper medical treatment. Not even the crude herbal poultices available to a Highland charmer at the time. How long would it have taken, jolting from Culloden to Brochturach in a wagon? 2 days? 3? How could he have lived in such a state, and neglected for so long?
He did, though.
Brianna's voice broke in upon my thoughts, answering what seemed to be a similar thought expressed by Roger. She spoke with simple assurance, as though she had seen all the events described in Melton's journal, and was sure of their outcome.
He did get back. He was the Dun Bonnet. I know it.
The Dun Bonnet?
Fiona, tutting over my cold cup of undrunk tea, looked over her shoulder in surprise.
"Heard of the Dun Bonnet, have you?"
"Have you?"
Roger looked at the young housekeeper in astonishment.
She nodded, casually dumping my tea into the aspidistra that stood by the hearth and refilling my cup with fresh steaming brew.
"Oh, aye. My granny telt me that tale often and often." "Tell us?"
Brianna leaned forward intent, her cocoa cupped between her palms.
"Please, Fiona, what's the story?"
Fiona seemed mildly surprised to find herself suddenly the centre of so much attention, but shrugged good-naturedly.
"Oh, that's just the story of one of the followers of the Bonnie Prince. When there was the great defeat at Culloden, and sae many were killed, a few escaped. Why? One man fled the field and swam the river to get away, but the redcoats were after him nonetheless. He came to a kirk along his way, and a service going on inside, and he, dashing in, prayed mercy from the minister. The minister and the people took pity on him, and he put on the minister's robe. So when the redcoats burst in moments later, there he was, standing at the pulpit, preaching the sermon, and the water from his beard and clothes puddled up about his feet. The redcoats thought they were mistaken and went on down the road, and so he escaped. And everyone in the kirk said it was the best sermon they ever heard."
Fiona laughed heartily, while Brianna frowned, and Roger looked puzzled.
"That was the Dun Bonnet," he said.
"But I thought, oh, no," she assured him. "That was no the Dun Bonnet. Only the Dun Bonnet was another of the men who got away from Culloden. He came back to his own estate, but because the Sassenachs were hunting men all across the Highlands, he lay hidden there in a cave for 7 years."
Hearing this, Brianna slumped back in her chair with a sigh of relief.
"And his tenants called him the Dun Bonnet so as not to speak his name and betray him," she murmured. "You ken the story?"
Fiona asked, astonished.
"Aye, that's right."
"And did your granny say what happened to him after that?"
Roger prompted.
"Oh, aye."
Fiona's eyes were round as butterscotch drops.
"That's the best part of the story. See, there was a great famine after Culloden. Folk were starving in the glens, turned out of their houses in winter. The men shot and the court set afire. The Dun Bonnet's tenants managed better than most, but even so, there came a day when the food ran out
and their bellies garbled from dawn till dark. No game in the forest, nae grain in the field, and the wains dying in their mother's arms for lack of milk to feed them. A cold chill swept over me at her words. I saw the faces of the Lallybroch inhabitants, the people I had known and loved, pinched with cold and starvation. Not only horror filled me, there was guilt too. I had been safe, warm and well-fed, instead of sharing their fate, because I had done as Jamie wanted and left them. I looked at Brianna, smooth red head bent in absorption, and the tight feeling in my chest eased a bit. She too had been safe for these past years, warm, well-fed, and loved, because I had done as Jamie wanted. So, he made a bold plan, the Dunbonnet did. Fiona was continuing. Her round face was alight with the drama of her tale. He arranged that one of his tenants should go to the English and offer to betray him. There was a good price on his head, for he'd been a great warrior for the prince. The tenant would take the gold of the reward, to use for the folk on the estate, of course, and tell the English where the Dunbonnet might be taken. My hand clenched so convulsively at this that the delicate handle of my teacup snapped clean off. Taken, I croaked, my voice hoarse with shock. Did they hang him? Fiona blinked at me in surprise. Why, no, she said. They wanted to, my granny said, and took him to trial for treason. But in the end, they shut him up in a prison instead. But the gold went to his tenants, and so they lived through the famine, she ended cheerfully, obviously regarding this as the happy ending. Jesus Christ, Roger breathed. He set his cup down carefully and sat staring into space, transfixed. Prison. You sound like that's good, Brianna protested. The corners of her mouth were tight with distress, and her eyes slightly shiny. It is, Roger said, not noticing her distress. There weren't that many prisons where the English imprisoned Jacobite traitors, and they all kept official records. Don't you see? He demanded, looking from Fiona's bewilderment to Brianna's scowl, then settling on me in hope of finding understanding. If he went to prison, I can find him. He turned then to look up at the towering shelves of books that lined three walls of the study, holding the late Reverend Wakefield's collection of Jacobite arcana. He's in there, Roger said softly, on a prison roll, in a document, real evidence. Don't you see? He demanded again, turning back to me. Going to prison made him a part of written history again, and somewhere in there we'll find him.
And what happened to him then, Brianna breathed, when he was released?
Roger's lips pressed tight together to cut off the alternative that sprang to his mind, as it had to mine.
Or died.
Yes, that's right, he said, taking Brianna's hand. His eyes met mine, deep green and unfathomable. When he was released. A week later, Roger's faith in documents remained unshaken. The same couldn't be said for the 18th century table in the late Reverend Wakefield's study, whose spindly legs wobbled and creaked alarmingly beneath their unaccustomed burden. This table normally was asked to accommodate no more than a small lamp and a collection of the Reverend's smaller artefacts. It was pressed into service now, only because every other horizontal surface in the study already overflowed with papers, journals, books, and bulging manila envelopes from antiquarian societies, universities, and research libraries across England, Scotland, and Ireland. "If you set one more page on that thing, it's going to collapse," Claire observed, as Roger carelessly reached out, meaning to drop the folder he was carrying on the little inlaid table.
"Ah? Oh! Right."
He switched direction in midair, looked vainly for another place to put the folder,
and finally settled for placing it on the floor at his feet.
"I've just about finished with Wentworth," Claire said. She indicated a precarious stack on the floor with her toe. "Have we got in the records for Berwick yet?"
"Yes, just this morning."